He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakaronga mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Great to have you with us. Today, some gravy with your grass, madam? We're looking at how dairy farmers might make the switch from taking pasture off cows and turning it directly into human food.
We talked to a vet in Bali about the foot and mouth outbreak there and potential risks for New Zealand.
A gorse-busting event around the Okarito Lagoon has been a huge success.
And high country merino farming meets hemp fibre innovation.
But first, to a quick skip around the country to look at farming conditions around the motu. As Friday started, many regions had been expecting to get pretty drenched. For some, that never really happened. But as one consultant said, if you want to know the weather, open the door and step outside. Northland's had a wet week with buffeting winds. But as you head further south, the week was okay. Quite mild, and wind and rain only arrived in force for Waikato, Bay of Plenty, King Country, late Thursday or Friday morning. For dairy herds just getting into calving, it's not so comfortable. Taranaki, like further north, has been quite mild, so grass growth is above average and farm pasture covers are good. Lower altitude farms are starting to calve, so the new season's on its way. Farm conditions are good, but it won't take much rain to tank things up.
It was meant to be pelting down on the east coast on Friday, but in the morning anyway, Gisborne wasn't too wet. But roads up the coast are still knocked around, and it doesn't take much rain for them to have slips and restrictions in place. Further south, and Wairarapa had a fine week with some frosty starts. A farmer I caught up with has been crutching and watching his ewes aren't over or underfed. Both states create lambing issues, and that's just around the corner. Pregnancy scanning results are down a bit this year.
Horo Whenua was getting smacked with wind and rain on Friday, but the rest of the week had been okay. On dairy farms, there have been quite a few with cows that have slipped, which means calves have arrived too early. Those calves generally come into milk, so sheds are being started up for just a few cows. Woodhaven Gardens, the large veggie grower here, will be floating again, but boxing on. Across Cook Strait and the Tasman region was wet on Friday, so orchardists lost a day's work. But the rest of the week's been okay, and everyone's got on with pruning apples and kiwi fruit. Those jobs are running a little behind because it has been wet prior to now, but it's okay.
Canterbury had a good patch of weather, so things have dried out and stock are utilising fodder crops well. Irrigation systems are getting serviced ahead of the new season. Our farmer here has 600 native plants ordered, and they'll be planted over the next couple of months as part of the ongoing farm planting programme. The West Coast's had a good week and didn't get much rain at all Thursday night into Friday, but it was blowing a gale, a very strong easterly.
Central Otago farmers are looking at mucky paddocks because the ground is frozen underneath. Thursday offered up a -8 morning, but the willows in Uturehua are budding up red, which is a real worry. It is not spring. Good snow was falling in Cromwell, Omarama and all the usual snowy mountain areas with a number of road closures. There was a cold easterly and rain in Southland on Friday. Before that, it's been okay. Again, as all the farmers are saying, it's winter.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Our guest this week is Ross Ainsworth, who's a consultant vet from Australia living in Bali. The tourist hotspot has just confirmed cases of foot and mouth disease among livestock. It's already widespread in other parts of Indonesia.
It's caused absolute mayhem in Java and Sumatra. It doesn't kill animals so much. It can kill a small number of animals, but the main thing is it makes them unable to eat and unable to stand up because the foot lesions, especially on larger animals, make it so painful they must lay down and they can't eat. So they just waste away. And in most cases, the animals are destroyed. The biggest impact's been on the dairy industry because most of the dairy cows obviously are sort of 400, 500, 600 kilos. And they just collapse. So they're so heavy on their feet, they can't stand up. Their lactation is finished, so they're commercially complete dud. And the only thing they can do is to slaughter them to virtually end their misery. This is such an amazingly infectious disease that it just goes like wildfire.
The issue, I understand, in Bali is a shortage of doses of the foot and mouth vaccination.
Well, that's the issue in most of the country, in fact, but Bali in particular. So the government's only brought in a limited amount of vaccine. When you want 10 million doses of vaccine, you don't get it next week. So they've only received a very small number of doses. They've prioritised them mainly to the dairy areas and some intensive beef areas in Java. And Bali's got 2,000 doses for 600,000 head of cattle, so and 700,000 pigs. So they're still scrambling to get vaccine from anywhere they can in the world. And I'm sure they're trying hard, but the results are pretty disappointing so far.
Bali reopened to tourists a few months back. How does that affect the risk for Australia and potentially New Zealand?
There are a number of factors which are all lining up together to make it at its absolute worst. So firstly, with no vaccine, the disease will be spreading fast and lots of animals be infected and shedding virus. So elsewhere in Asia, where there's plenty of foot and mouth disease, it's pretty much blanket vaccinated. So there's only a very small number of animals get infected and shed virus. So your chances of coming across one are pretty slim. So Bali has the disease, no vaccine, and then the Balinese love their cattle and they have them in the backyard and then they walk them out during the day to graze and they bring them home at night. So they walk them past your villa and there's plenty of opportunities for tourists to come across discharges from cattle, if not the cattle themselves. And so until vaccine arrives, the cows will be at their sort of shedding their maximum virus and they're in a place where they'll be interacting with a lot of tourists. I live in the main area of Seminyak and there are cattle here everywhere. There are pigs here as well. This is a Hindu island. The rest of Indonesia is Muslim, but this is a Hindu island, Bali, and so they have lots of pigs. And pigs spread the virus much more efficiently than even cattle do. So we've got heavy shedding of virus in a place where the cattle are, in many cases, close to where the tourists are, and we don't have any vaccine yet. So we're in this very dangerous window before they're fully vaccinated, and it might take a year, 6 months or a year. And of course, tourists have just started to turn up in big numbers. I was at a restaurant today and it was full. It's almost in the last 2 or 3 weeks that tourist numbers have gone through the roof.
So are the authorities stopping animals from roaming about? What's being done to control the outbreak?
Well, they're restricting movement in the big picture. Animals can't go onto or off Bali, but there's nothing they can do to stop a farmer having grazing his cows around the town. Short answer, there is no restriction. If they find animals that are infected, they'll probably be too sick to be walking anywhere. But apart from that, it's very difficult to control animals in this environment.
So what do you think New Zealand authorities should be doing about this?
Well, my suggestion, the Australian authorities have upgraded their biosecurity arrangements, specifically at the airports that receive the most of Bali tourists, and things like more dogs looking for food in luggage, more questions to the tourists and asking them about their shoes and their clothes, have they been on a farm. But I don't think it's enough, to be honest. I think we're in this such a dangerous window that we need footbaths to be operational. You know, they're just sponges on the ground in a tray with some disinfectant so that people's shoes are clean underneath where they would possibly have come across some virus on the ground. Otherwise, the virus can easily last 2 days in a bit of organic matter under your shoe. But the government's resisting this in Australia because they say, well, mostly people wear thongs when they're coming and going to Bali and, you know, it might irritate their feet. Well, I think it's more important to irritate a few feet than to get the virus delivered to Australia.
Our authorities have gone to Indonesia to investigate the risks in the palm kernel supply chain. That's feed for our cattle. Is the risk of transmission via tourists a bigger one in your view?
Probably, yes. There are protocols to ensure that the palm kernel cake is manufactured in a safe way. So I think that's quite a low risk, but there are biosecurity measures to make sure that that's the case. Travelling tourists are the risk. I'm not sure if there are direct flights, but even if they're via Melbourne or Sydney or something, you'd still be home in less than 24 hours and the virus can last on your shoe for 48. So big danger.
Consultant vet Ross Ainsworth speaking to us from Bali. The Ministry for Primary Industries says New Zealand already has some of the toughest biosecurity measures against foot and mouth. It says the risk to this country is low, especially without direct flights at the moment, but it's taking extra steps, including stepped up baggage searches at the border and putting out more information to people arriving from countries of risk. Vets are on the alert, and it's reminding farmers to keep up strong general biosecurity plans on farm. MPI says its recent audit of Indonesia's palm kernel supply chain shows it is meeting New Zealand's strict biosecurity requirements for foot and mouth.
In April this year, volunteers from all over New Zealand headed to South Westland for a week to clear gorse from around the edges of the stunning Okarito Lagoon. The event was dubbed Gorsebusters 2 after the success of the first Okarito Gorsebusters event held last year. Local tourism operator Barry Hughes is one of the organisers.
Me and my partner Gemma co-own Okarito Kayaks, and we decided maybe, I think about 2 years ago, we were going to just start a small project here on the lagoon to cut gorse, get some volunteers, probably about 20 people. And so we kind of initiated this with the idea it would be a lot smaller. And a year and a half later, after the first one, now in the middle of the second one, we've got about 80 people a day for 6 days working around the lagoon, cutting gorse and looking after the place. We have people who've flown from Auckland, we have people who've driven from Hawke's Bay, we have people who've driven up from Invercargill. We've got about half the people who were here last year who've come back this year for the week, given up their time, they've travelled to chop gorse.
Mo Killip is one of the volunteers.
So last year I was over in Tidal Creek and Cemetery Creek, and that was kind of, you could see where the edge was and it was a lot easier. And this year, the first day we were up at the Delta, and that was hard yakka, to be honest. It was just totally wet. You couldn't really tell. You were in a reed bed in a swamp with the gorse.
It's an incredibly convoluted series of bays and river deltas that you're working into. And so about 19 kilometres or so we worked on last year, you know, it's definitely haven't eradicated the gorse in there, but some areas are literally unrecognisable to what they were before. And so this year we've gone back and we're consolidating what we've done before. We're going over that whole 19 Ks. We can then start to expand into new areas, which is actually what we're doing today. We've got people on what's called Racecourse Island, just across the water. Tomorrow we'll have people pushing further into the river deltas that are ecologically really valuable.
When we first got here, everyone said, pace yourself, pace yourself.
Rookie gorsebuster Eve Pomeroy is finding the work physically challenging.
You're sort of cutting and having to haul logs out of the way and stuff, so it's definitely tiring. And they were right when they said that the gorse was kind of like this round, like it's pretty big. So you chop it off, and apparently we've been told that you have to paste it really, really quickly, otherwise the plant shuts down, goes back into itself and won't take the poison with it. So we put like a thin layer of poison on the top, and then the plant sucks that down into the roots, which kills it.
I live on the Coromandel. I run an ecology project up there, so I'm really into doing things like this. So I decided I'd drive down.
Chris Wodenberg and his gorse-busting team drew the short straw.
We got dumped in the deep end on the Delta, so right into the thick of the gorse. The arms and the legs, they get a bit cut up. Yesterday the mud was over knee height, so I was walking along and just disappeared down a big mud hole, so that was a bit of fun getting the pick out and trying to keep my shoe on.
We found out about Gorsebusters last year. I heard Baz on the radio and said to Richard, oh, Richard, we could do this. And so we did. We had a great time last year, so we came back this year.
Teacher Karen Townsend and her husband are over from Christchurch.
We've got our own kayaks, so we have been kayaking right up into the deltas of the creeks. Last year we did Tidal Creek, and this year we've done Cemetery Creek. So it's a very reedy area, so wet feet, and in closer to the cliff area, very, very boggy. But my husband saw a bittern, which is quite unusual, on Monday. So he was all excited about that. And today we saw a fern bird. and they are really quite rare to see. And we've seen white herons each day.
This is an extraordinary area for bird life, and having that native vegetation that those birds have thrived in for thousands of years being marred and taken over by something like gorse threatens that. So there's some ecological significance here to doing it that there might not be in regenerating farmland where gorse can be useful. But on a wetland community, it's a real threat.
The first day started with a splash for Barb Simpson.
To get us here fast, there's a couple of jet skis available to bring people out to start work. And so two of us got on a jet ski with this lovely man, Russell. And as he stepped down, it was much deeper than he imagined. He didn't have his feet on the bottom. And so he went in backwards. And as he did, he tipped the jet ski over on its sort of on its side and put the other two of us in the water. And it's quite unpleasant sort of whipping off backwards and going under with all your gear on. Yeah, so we managed to straggle to the shore, and I ended up going back to get changed because I was getting cold. So, yeah, but it was an exciting start to the day.
To come and chop gorse for a week in a wetland on the west coast, it doesn't immediately sound like the most tempting proposition in the world. And we're encouraging people to go at their own pace. You know, everyone out there is a volunteer. Everyone's giving their time. The work can be really hard, but we do want people back next year. We probably shouldn't mention next year yet, but we want them to enjoy what they're doing and to have that sense of camaraderie, but to be effective too.
I have never been to Okarita before. I've heard a lot about it, and it feels like a really New Zealand sort of batchy location. You've got a really epic backdrop of the Southern Alps behind you, and this is the first year that we've come. We only just heard about a couple of weeks ago, so we jumped on last minute, and at this rate, based on the food alone, I think we'll probably come back again.
Eve is talking about the culinary work co-organiser Gemma van Beek is doing in the makeshift kitchen.
We're in Donovan's Store, which is the oldest wooden building on the west coast and basically functions as a kind of community hall. We've got 10 slow cookers on the go at the moment making dinner, because obviously one oven doesn't make dinner for 90-odd people. So we're having Andalusian meat tonight because it's a mixture of lamb and venison, because that's what we've got.
We hadn't intended to feed everyone, but then we started getting donations of food from small businesses and local farmers and people doing home baking or dropping off a deer for people. And it really grew from there, and it sort of created a bit of a monster, it feels like, but a good one.
Owen Petey is a two-time Gorsebuster.
I've come from Invercargill, but I didn't do it all in one hit, though, like last year. It's just too far to drive in one day. I've been working on Stewart Island for the last 6 months, doing conservation work on Stewart Island, and I've also been doing Darwin's Barberry, which is a weed, so I've been doing similar work that we're doing here today. Plus, I've been doing pest control as well, because it was this job last year that got me interested in conservation. Yeah, and hopefully it's opened up some new doors for me.
Gem and Baz are just amazing. They've managed to just get it together. I think lots of people want to do good, and if someone gives you the opportunity to do it, then people will take it. And they've just had the whole of this southwestland behind them, as far as I can tell.
It's not really possible to put into words how proud we are. It just goes back to that simplicity of a Kiwi working bee and just going out and helping your mates. A small town of 40 people, kind of at the end of the world in a way, to get this much support, I mean, it blows you away, really. You know, genuinely, it blows you away.
Gorsebusters organiser Barry Hughes there from Okarito on the west coast. And if you'd like to see a beautiful video RNZ's own Nate McKinnon has captured about the six-day event, go to the Country Life page on the RNZ website.
I'm Robin Green, I live at Tihoro Beach, and I have to say that Country Life is one of my favourite programmes, Country Life on RNZ National.
It's hard to believe, but in the future I could be dining out on the grass in this paddock, because New Zealand scientists are well on the way to creating very nutritious human food from pasture. It certainly gives a new meaning to the term paddock to plate. But any new plant protein industry does depend on farmers being incentivised to lock up some of their land for things like grass burgers, So the agribusiness firm Baker Ag is looking into this with funding from the research agency Our Land and Water. And I've come to find out more from one of their consultants.
I'm Sarah Hawkins, and we're standing here today in the middle of a paddock on Stolk Dairy Farm, located just south of Marston and the Wairarapa. Beautiful sunny day. We had a good frost this morning, but it looks like it's going to clear out and become a stunner.
They have eaten down this paddock by the look of things.
Yeah, so they've just finished grazing off their break for this morning, and they're going to head into the feed barn in probably about 15-20 minutes and get their supplement for the day before they head back to a paddock until this afternoon's milking.
Now, this study that you're doing is all about grass. It's about pasture.
It is.
Tell us about the concept of grass burgers.
Basically, Plant and Food, Fonterra and Palmer have come up with this technology where they're able to extract human edible proteins out of pasture, so what cows eat. So they're able to extract that protein out, which is going to become a food additive moving forward. What us as Baker Ag are doing, we're doing, how does this work on a dairy farm? How can it fit in to a dairy farm as part of their systems without causing too many disruptions, but also adding to the system and hopefully improving the environmental outcomes of that dairy farm?
Can I leap in there and ask you just a little bit more about the idea of eating grass? Because it's such a radical idea, isn't it?
It is. It's. I haven't tried any of the products yet, to be fair. I still think of, you know, we've got the perfect animals out there that are that converter. You know, they take grass and they turn it into edible proteins. But going forward, they do have an environmental implication. They create greenhouse gas emissions. You know, there is an issue with nitrates in the waterways. So what we're doing is looking at alternative ways to get human digestible food while also maintaining the viability of dairy farms and potentially in the future sheep and beef farms.
The idea is to take the cow out of the equation with this so that the protein in the grass goes directly to the human.
Yes, that's correct. So what we do, we remove the cows from the paddock effectively. Instead of cows eating it, we bring a tractor in and harvest it like you would for silage. Instead of making silage out of it, it goes to a big processing factory. They do whatever magic they do, and out the bottom comes a human digestible protein, which can be turned into a food additive, maybe added to, you know, the no dairy cheese or into a protein powder.
A patty?
A patty, probably. what remains out of what's extracted, so the fibre stuff, that can actually be imported back onto the dairy farm as a food supplement for the cows on the dairy farm. So it's quite a full cycle. There's nothing getting wasted.
So let's go into the whys around this. What is the reasoning behind taking some of this pasture away from the cow to ruminate on?
Well, I mean, there's a number of factors for that. First one is there's increasing demand for non-animal high-quality food, so this is hoping to meet part of that market, which is obviously why the research has been done. But it has the added benefit of if there's less cows on farm, there's going to be less of that environmental implications from either the methane emissions, but also those urine depositions and effluent, which not always, but if poorly managed, can have an adverse environmental effect, which if you consider high-density dairy farming areas like the Canterbury Plains, like areas in Southland, areas in the Hawke's Bay, you know, collectively, on-farm it might only be small, but collectively it can be a bigger problem. And so there are regional councils in those areas have already indicated that there is going to be drastic change in some of these catchments moving forward within the next generation or two. So by doing this research, we're hoping to highlight opportunities for dairy farmers so that they can still have the cows, still have the dairy farm, still remain financially viable while also reducing their environmental footprint.
So basically fewer cows producing less greenhouse gases and also the nitrates.
Yeah. So with the Our Land and Water, because it's the water focus, the focus is on the nitrates as opposed to the methane. The methane is a happy side effect.
So that would mean the farmer locking away more of his or her pasture for this particular purpose, because already they would do that for silage,
yes,
wouldn't they?
So normally what happens is you've got a pasture demand curve and a pasture supply curve based on what grows and what needs to be eaten by your dairy cows. They never match exactly. And so what you'll do is anytime you've got a surplus of feed, you'd lock it up and cut it for silage or baleage, and then you'd feed it out when you don't have enough feed growing. Instead of that, what we're doing is we are reducing the stocking rate. So there's less cows, so that supply and demand, there is a lot more supply than demand. So we lock up a greater proportion of that farm, and that instead, some of it will still get turned to silage for the cows maybe, but most of it will go to that factory to get that human degradable protein taken out of it.
Baker Ag's going to be using farms in Southland, Canterbury and Hawke's Bay as case studies. The farmers involved are open to alternatives, especially as they face drastically reducing their nitrate emissions to clean up waterways.
You know, some of them are facing restrictions of 90%. You know, I think the farm down in Matara, he said that they've been told they want a 90% reduction in nitrate emissions within the next generation. So without an alternate source of income, that farm's now not financially viable. So we're hoping that this is going to prove that there are other options for these farmers. They can continue milking some of the cows, provide that really good quality milk that they continue doing, but also provide these other proteins that can be turned into human digestible feed.
There is a catch, though. These grass burgers, I'm going to keep calling them that because it does conjure up quite an interesting image. They'll need to fetch the right price for farmers to be interested. And as the cows make their way to the barn to get their feed, I put that to Sarah Hawkins.
It looks like the protein price needs to be linked to that milk price, because if a farmer is saying that they could get $9.50 per kilo of milk solid, but they're only going to get the equivalent of, say, $5 per kilo of protein, they're not, you know, that's a $4.50 difference. So it kind of needs to be linked to that milk price, unless there is some significant benefits from the environmental side of it, which is also why we're targeting these environmental catchments, to see what additional benefit, whether it's financial or not, is this going to bring to a farm environmentally.
There are other plant proteins out there that farmers could go into,
yep.
Say soy or
peas, almond trees. The benefit of using the grass is it's already there, so it's not going to have the additional cost of establishing a new grass or establishing a new cross, and the cost that actually has on the environment. A lot of people aren't aware that, you know, every time you cultivate a paddock, you're releasing nitrogen, and that has its own environmental implications. Whereas if you've got a permanent pasture, it's already established, it's already healthy, and so there's no extra work for the farmer. It's already part of the system, as opposed to having to go out and learn a whole new skill around cropping and the additional, the education that would be required. And often those aren't suitable crops to be grown in New Zealand climates, or we can't do them cost-effectively. You know, America and Australia have these huge, huge farms with economies of scale. New Zealand farms don't have that. We're quite little comparatively. We do what we do really well, but we don't have those economies of scale to produce, you know, the large-scale soybean or peas that could bring that cost down of that protein. So I suppose the benefit of why it's grass is it's already on farm, it's part of a system, the farmers already know it, there's no drastic change to the system for them, so they're going to be more open to it for the most part.
And on the average size dairy farm, how much pasture at this stage do you think would be worth a farmer locking up?
We're still probably going to initially look at that 10, 15, 20%. Because beyond that, the farmer will start losing economies of scale. They might have to drop a stock, a staff unit, that sort of thing. We don't want to drastically change the farm system at this point. But going forward, that might be something that we look into. But for the purpose of the study, it's just likely to be that 10 to 20% of the farm system that would take out.
And would a farmer need to make more investments, more technology to actually process this stuff, or would it be sent to a centralised area?
So the idea is that it'll be sent to a centralised area. So basically the way we're working it and the way we're modelling it and our understanding of it is that basically the farm shrinks his area, the land that is for the pasture protein is effectively not leased out, but they'll do the nitrogen applications, but the harvest company, the processing company, they'll come in and they'll do the cutting of and, the harvesting of that grass and take it to their centralised location to process it so that they can harvest it at the optimum time for them. If a farmer was required to do that, it would get a bit harder because he's going to have to do that around his day-to-day business. And so the pasture might not be cut at the optimum time, that sort of thing. So that's why we've, in our modelling, it gets outsourced to the processor.
And just finally, Sarah, let's just talk about this in a global sense. How good is New Zealand pasture in terms of protein?
So good. The only other comparable country is probably Ireland. We've got quite similar climates. We've got that maritime temperate sort of climate. And so we grow really good quality ryegrass. You know, it's 12 ME, so megajoules of metabolizable energy. Whereas, you know, you go to somewhere like Canada or America, not so sure about Europe, I haven't really looked into it, but they can grow a lot of feed for a very short period of time, and then it's just too cold or too hot, depending on which side of the country. And so they can't have the grass-based system that we have, because their feed system, their plant growth systems just don't work the same way. So we're extremely lucky in New Zealand with our climate and what we can grow and how we can feed our animals.
And possibly our humans.
And possibly our humans going forward, which is pretty exciting.
Sarah Hawkins of the agribusiness consultancy Baker Ag. And she says nitrogen would still need to be applied to the pasture intended for human consumption. But without the urine patches from cows in the mix, it's expected there would be less wastage and leaching of nitrogen.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National. Paul and Prue Ensor farm at Glen Ann Station in the Canterbury High Country. When Cosmo popped in to visit them recently, their three children, Juliet, Guy and Hugh, took him to the kennels to show off the newest members of the farm team.
Who have you got there?
This is Ruff.
Now, has Ruff got some puppies?
Yeah, she's got three.
Let's have a look. They're like little sausages.
Yeah.
One's more of a tub.
So these will be sheepdogs?
Yeah. The mum's a beardy hunterway.
And what about the dad?
We're not too sure what breed the dad is.
How many dogs have you got on the farm here?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 work dogs, and then we have a Labrador and a Border Terrier.
Juliet, what's it like for you living here on this rather isolated high country station?
It's pretty fun. It's really cool, yeah.
What do you do in the weekends?
Help Dad and Mum, like, move sheep, do break fences, help on the farm and play with my brothers.
And what school do you go to?
I go to Mount Hutt College in Methven.
It must take quite a while for you to get to school every day.
Yeah, we get on the bus at 7:20 and it's like an hour and 15 minutes on the bus. Mm. Yeah.
Who's top dog here?
Tink.
Tink, yeah.
How come?
She's just very well behaved usually and hard working. And she's a hunterway, so she's black and like a tan colour with brown eyes, and she's short haired.
Paul, how long have you had Tink for?
Tink, we must have had her for probably 3 or 4 years. We had an older team and she was the first of the new younger dogs that came through, so she's probably what most farmers would call their mainstay, their main dog. Mm. Does a lot of the work, and we're quite reliant on her at the moment. But I've got a young shepherd as well who's got a team of dogs, and he does a lot of the management of the livestock, and he focuses on that and does a really great job. So we're very fortunate to retain him for 3 years, and he's very crucial to what we do here.
Because I do hear from some farmers that it's quite hard to find good staff nowadays.
Yeah, the retention of good staff is a challenge, and then finding them to start with is there. We're seeing actually a new wave of young people coming through at the moment. We had a call during the week, you know, someone looking for a job. And it's hard to attract people out into these remote areas where there's not a pub just down the road and a corner shop. So, yeah, it's been a challenge.
You'd have to be okay about being on your own a lot of the time.
Yeah. I mean, invariably here in this sort of area, you end up working a lot on your own. There are a number of younger people in the area who work on the farms, neighbouring farms, so it's good for them to keep in contact with each other and do things together. So we've got a wee community hub, which is our local fire station, which we meet sort of once a month. And we have a fire practice, and then we have a catch-up over a beer and a barbecue. So there's a bit of that happens as well.
How often have you had to put a fire out?
Not too often, maybe once or twice a year we get called out to various areas.
Okay, so we are going to head out onto the farm now.
So the
property we can see in the distance in the trees is Glenarif Station, which is where my father grew up. So in 1916, my great-grandfather, in conjunction with a couple of brother-in-laws, bought the three main runs up this valley. And he then, in 1921, he had three sons. So they, well, actually had four sons. One stayed in the home place down near Ringura. And then he had three other boys came up and ran the three properties. And those three properties are now, what are they, five, six properties. They've been split up as generations come through. And five of them are still within our family, which is good to see.
So did you take over the farm that your parents were running?
Yes, so we came back from overseas in 2004 and took over the farm. We'd been away for a couple of years overseas, and I'd worked in Wellington for a meat exporting company for a couple of years, so it was really cool to come back. And I don't know, after working in an office for a few years, it's quite cool to come back and work outside and be your own boss. And yeah, it's a great place to have a family as well, so it's worked out really well for us.
Now we're driving down towards your farmyards, and beyond them we can see the mighty Rakaia River. And on the other side, there's quite a well-known station, isn't there?
Yeah, so opposite us, which is directly north, is Mount Algidus Station. Probably best known for when Mona Anderson wrote a book about it, A River Rules My Life, telling her story about living on quite an isolated high country farm. They have to cross the Wilberforce River to get access to the property, so that's cut off quite regularly.
Hmm. So where are we heading to now?
So we've got three distinct land types. There's the hill country, and then we've got some nice alluvial fans around the homestead, and now we're heading down onto the river flat, which has sort of got more recent soils, and got a large area of lucerne based pastures, which we just having their final, the sheep are having their final grazing rotation on before they come back to the homestead area for their full winter feeding program.
We are heading into a paddock. All handy having the kids in the car to do the gates.
Yeah, it's great to have a gate opener. Makes life a lot easier. And they're getting more and more handy by the day, so it's good.
We're going to join that one to the other gate too.
There's always a bit of fear with gate opening about electric shocks, so every now and then I have to do with them still.
Now in this paddock, there's quite a large mob of sheep.
These are wether lambs, so they were born back in September, October last year. So they're merinos. We run quite a fine merino flock. They're probably 15, 16 microns, which is sort of the diameter of the wool. And that can go into anything like woven suiting to your icebreakers, which is probably what everyone associates merino with. So yeah, these are just young animals, and we're just making sure we look after them well at this time of the year because it's getting colder. So they're on a new bit of grass every day or two, and they're also getting some silage.
How many are in the mob here?
In this mob, I think there's just under 1,300. So yeah, we're just going to take them out of this paddock, throw another one to the next paddock, which they'll last them a day or two.
Just top out and get the dog in the way.
Your dog knows exactly what to do.
Yeah, she's much smarter than me sometimes, so it always makes life easier.
Is that Tink?
Yeah, that's Tink out there, giving them a bit of a hurry up. There's one over here that's still asleep, so we might have to go and wake it up.
There we are, the slightly startled wether is running back to the mob, chased by Tink.
So I grew up here. We had a little school down the road, and I think when I left there was only five of us there, so that closed not long after we left, but the school roll peaked at 14.
So a tiny school. What was that like?
Oh, it was cool. We had a great time, and it was a pretty unique place to grow up. And I think of the seven who were on the roll, two who lived across another river only came a couple of days a week. And then, so of the five, I think four of us were related. So, yeah, it's a pretty unique sort of environment to grow up in.
Who was your teacher?
Mr. Baker, and he was a real character. He had a pipe and he'd smoke that, you know, all day. And it was good fun. We had a lot of fun playing in the creek next to the school and all that sort of stuff. It was good times.
Paul, can you tell me what we can see around us?
So as we look sort of due west, I guess, we're looking up into the main divide of the Rakaia, so the headwaters of the Rakaia. And in the middle of the valley here, we've got Double Hill, which is a Rushmutone, which is a glacial formation. So when the glacier came out of the Rakaia and the Matthias rivers up in the headwaters, it was a bit of hard rock in the valley floor, which the glaciers went over the top of, and where they converged, it kind of scoured out a wee sort of saddle in the middle of the hard bit of rock, so it looks like a double hump, if you like, of a camel. So that sits in the middle of the valley floor. And then I guess we're just sort of surrounded by mountains to the south and the north, and Arthur's Pass is directly north of us. I'm not sure how far, it might be 30 kilometres away. And actually where we sit in the valley here at the moment, it's actually to the west coast, it's the same equidistance to the west and the east coast, so we're pretty much right in the centre of the South Island. Mm.
And there is snow on all the mountains around us?
Yeah, the snow's sitting probably at its sort of typical level for the winter, which is probably down to about 1,000 metres in altitude. In the old days, they used to call the snow line our boundary, so in the winter, before the winter, they'd bring all the stock down to a certain level, and then once the snow layer set itself in, then they'd just let the stock go back up again, and they wouldn't go up into the snow, so they called it, basically the snow created a boundary fence for the winter.
And there is a walkway that passes through your farm.
Yeah, so we've got the Te Aroa Trail, which goes through our property. So that's the national walkway that runs the length of New Zealand. So we have people, pre-COVID, there was a lot of international people walking through the property. That's sort of something that a lot of people come out to New Zealand to do. And not so many Kiwis, but we've seen more Kiwis in the last couple of years coming through. So it runs, probably 3 or 4 km. It walks through the middle of our property, follows a creek out and into the Ashburton Conservation Park. Hecatary Conservation Park, and we're actually at a trailhead, so people can't cross, they're advised not to walk across the Rakaia River for obvious reasons for safety, so they actually stop, it's a real start and stop point, so people go back to Methven to resupply and then start from the other side of the river.
Mm. So do you have a number of stiles that they can climb over? Or?
Yeah, so there's obviously a few fences that the walkway crosses, so there's the stiles and there's also horse gates there, and we have a wee Airbnb cottage on the farm too, so people can stay there and do parts of the trail if they choose as well.
How far is the first hut from here?
It's probably a 3-hour walk from here, and then there's another one probably a couple hours after that, so people stay in different huts, and some people even camp along the trail as well.
Little Tink, get up here.
What are your main revenue streams here?
A lot of our income comes from our merino wool. We share that through August, September, and that merino wool would probably make up well over half of our annual income. So we've got to be very careful about how we manage the sheep through this period, particularly now leading up to shearing, to make sure we keep the quality in the wool and keep them well fed so they produce a really good fleece of wool, which processes well and is made into really good quality garments.
How much wool will they grow a year?
So a young animal like that will get about three kilos off them, and the ewes closer to 5 kilos. You might get three tops out of 1 kilo, so, they're clothing quite a few people per year per sheep.
Mm. So feeding can really impact on the quality of the wool.
Yeah, absolutely. If they didn't get very well fed for even a week, the micron would narrow up and the wool would get a break in it, so it wouldn't be as strong. So then people buying it to process it would break in the yarn, and then they'd have all sorts of trouble knitting it into fabrics that they wanted to.
Could you get the micron even lower here, or have you reached the finest wool possible that you can do?
We're actually not really trying to go any finer. In fact, we're possibly going slightly stronger at the moment. We're trying to have an animal which is more dual purpose, so it produces plenty of lambs and grows good wool. So at the moment we're sort of transitioning to what's called a pole merino, so a merino that's sort of higher fertility, has more lambs that grow faster. So we're sort of, to complement our wool business, we're trying to make sure we've got a good diverse product range.
Yes. Gosh, the mob have moved a long way down towards the river there.
Yeah, I think they found another gate and they've headed into the next paddock, which I didn't know was open, so we'll have to go and bring them back to where they're supposed to be.
So what sort of cattle do you run here?
We've got an Angus beef herd is our main kettle. We trade a few cattle through various times of year, depending on the feed supply as well.
So do they follow behind the sheep and clean up?
Yeah, they do, yep. And we've got other areas where the cattle do a better job, so that... Ooh, crikey, it's a bit rough here. They graze parts of the hill that the sheep don't really go into. The merinos like to climb up and the cattle would like to stay at the bottom, so they're quite complimentary.
Paul, we have come up to a high point on your farm and we're standing beside a trig station. Tell me about this.
Well, it's not something I know a lot about, but I believe from each trig station you can see two or three other points. So when they originally mapped a lot of New Zealand, they sort of used to triangulate to make the maps. So it's a fixed point, obviously, they surveyed from. They knew the altitude and everything from that.
So how long do your merinos stay on this higher hill country?
It always depends on the type of season we've had. So there's actually a mob of ewes you can see up here, sort of higher up. They're sort of at maybe 700-800 metres there, and they're due to come down this next week, and we'll start feeding them in their winter feeding regime.
You must love going up and doing the mustering.
Yeah, it's always great to get up the hill there, and it's nice and quiet and away from any distractions, and out there with the dogs. It's always a good day out and good fresh bit of air to clear the mind away.
Do you guys go and do some mustering too?
Yeah.
Yep.
We leave in the morning, 8 a.m., and then we go up the hill, get the sheep, and then bring them back down to wherever they're going, to the yards or another paddock.
Do you have to walk?
Yeah, yep. Walk and get them with the dogs.
Quite steep hills. You must be exhausted when you get home.
Yeah, but sometimes we can drive up because we've got a zigzag track at the bottom there. Oh.
Now, as well as being a high country farmer, you are also involved in a startup called Hemprino.
Yeah, look, I did a rural leadership course about 4 years ago, and a friend I made on that course, Siobhan O'Malley, she came to me one day and she said, do you know of anyone who blends merino and hemp fibre together? And at that stage, I hadn't heard of anyone, so I did a bit of research, and she said, well, why don't we join forces and see if we can't bring a product to market that combines merino and hemp fibre in a unique way. So we've been working on that for 3.5 years now, and we've finally just brought something together which we're able to start selling to consumers. Yes.
And you're making clothing?
Yes, so we're making, at this stage, we initially just started with a crew jersey, just one product and one colour, but now we're rapidly broadening our range, so we now sell a hoodie, a V-neck, a woolly hat and a scarf, all made of this blend of hemp and merino.
And how would you describe the fabric?
The fabric's amazing, so it's got a really soft, luscious, luxurious feel, and it's quite unique in its appearance that the hemp doesn't take up dye like the merino does, so it's kind of got this, what they call a melange look or a fleck through it, and it looks really cool, and it's got an amazing soft feel, so yeah, we were really happy with it and excited to share it with consumers.
What were some of the challenges early on when you were trying to blend the two different fibres?
I guess one of our bigger challenges has been finding the right quality hemp that would blend well with the merino. So we actually did a study trip to China to try and work with a mill over there that could help us blend the two. The challenge is matching the length of hemp fibre with the merino and the right quality. So we're now in our third iteration of yarn to help develop something that's really knittable and gives a really nice, user-friendly, soft feel.
So do you have to source the hemp from China?
At this stage we are, yeah. There's hemp fibre grown in New Zealand, but it's processed not to the right quality which we require at the moment, so we're working very closely with New Zealand Natural Fibres, which is a subsidiary of Carfields, who have been developing the hemp fibre industry in New Zealand. So we hope as soon as product becomes available in New Zealand, that's something we'll grab and start using along with our New Zealand wool.
And do you use the wool from this property here?
So initially we didn't actually know what type of quality of merino we wanted, so we haven't used our own wool because we've been all about trying to get a product up and running. So it's certainly our intent, but we've probably used three different types of merino wool to date. So we've always been about getting the product right, and then we'll start using our own farm story as part of the product.
Mm. And how important was it for you to make that big trip to China just to really refine what you were doing?
Yeah, look, it was a really interesting time for us to go over there and just see how big the industry is and learn a lot about how it was produced over there and made. But then COVID hit, so we actually brought all our manufacturing back into New Zealand. So we're solely made in New Zealand now. So our yarn's made up in Wellington, and our tops are knitted up in Auckland. So it's a little bit more expensive to produce, but we get a really great quality product, and we've got some really good partners that we work with. So we're very proud to do that.
So how do you sell your clothing?
Yes, so at the moment we're web-based, so we have a website, hemprino.co.nz. We're available in one store in Methven, which is being a ski town, so hopefully we'll get a few people through to have a look at it. But we have some pretty big aspirations. We want to grow a really big business that we can, you know, with farm succession, not all family members can get involved in farming. So as we're three families involved in the business, if we can grow a business that can enable our children to get involved in different aspects of it, that would be a really great success for us, I think.
Paul Ensor there, who farms at Glen Ann Station in the Rakaia Gorge and co-owns the Hemprino clothing brand.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Do try and stay dry. It's going to be a wet one. Ka kite.
Bye now.